From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
They told me this is a good song. I'll dance to it.
Now, the members of the Americanism Commission, which I don't see anyone here.
He's not from Mexico.
In my opinion,
he's from Indiana.
And what everybody's trying to do is to use us as a scapegoat.
I don't agree that that's a good excuse, but I understand it.
If they can do it now, and they would be able to do it then what changes now?
There's a bit of the week's news out of context for you. We'll try to put it into some context here on The Wheelhouse today with our own Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. He had a small role in this week's news as a hurricane threatening the eastern seaboard. Welcome back, Colin.
Yes, and I just want to say that one little clip where the guy says, now the members of the Americanism Commission, which I don't see anyone here, they're speaking, this is sad, they're speaking at the 34th annual Nathan Hale State Capitol Ceremony. So whoever the Americanism Commission people are, they should have been there.
I hope that they're listening today. Also with us is Mark Pazniokas, because he spends a lot of time at the state capitol covering the capitol for the Connecticut Mirror. Hi, once again, Paz.
Great to be here.
You have the same birthday as Nathan Hale.
Yes, I listened in on the ceremony. I did not go downstairs. Forgive me.
So, yes, you're part of the problem, actually. Happy birthday, Paz.
Oh, thank you.
Also with us is Suzanne Bates, Director of Policy at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy here in Connecticut. Suzanne, always good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, at WNPR Wheelhouse. Let's start with the events of yesterday. On Monday evening, the Associated Press declared that Hillary Clinton had enough delegates to win the Democratic presidential nomination. Yesterday, she won in four more states, including the biggest prize of California. We'll get to some of my questions about the timing of all this, but first, let's hear the now presumptive nominee talking about a bit of history.
Tonight's victory is not about one person. It belongs to generations of women and men who struggled and sacrificed and made this moment possible.
So for a few weeks, Colin, we've known that Donald Trump is the presumptive nominee for the Republicans. Now Hillary Clinton is the presumptive nominee for the Democrats.
Yeah, and there'll still be some struggles about that, and I assume that's what we're about to talk about. But I actually watched a good chunk of last night's speech live, and it was a good speech for her, actually. She seemed... Maybe this is sort of what she needed. She seemed a little bit more...
To win?
Yeah. She seemed a little bit more centered and focused and delivered, I thought, a pretty strong message. Maybe this kind of coalescing of support is going to shift her style a little bit.
Paz?
Has there ever been a stranger moment of victory in American politics?
Probably.
I mean, you know, on a Monday night, oh, by the way, AP puts out a story about 8:30 saying, hey, our guy Steve Olemacher, an old friend from The Current, by the way, got hold of that last superdelegate and put Hillary over the top. You know, it didn't have that Jerry Lewis, we've gone over the top in the early morning hours moment that we used to have in the old telethons.
Well, yeah, and I want to ask a little bit more about that in a moment. But first of all, Suzanne, your take, your feeling perhaps on listening to Hillary Clinton last night as she claims California outright, she claims these other states, and she essentially is now the presumptive nominee. She's saying it's history.
I didn't hear the speech. It's historic. But I want you to imagine for a second that it was like Sarah Palin clinching the nominee for the Republicans and her being the first woman. Just because it's a woman doesn't mean that every woman feels really excited about her candidacy, and I would be one of those people.
You just forced us to think about Sarah Palin as the nominee
exactly.
for the Republicans.
Exactly. Well, that's honestly how, I mean, you know, I really am not a fan of Hillary Clinton, and so that's kind of how I feel. You know?
Now I will say,
John, have you heard of the Yankee Institute?
I have heard of the Yankee Institute. Here's what I would say is,
I'm not a Sarah Palin.
The difference between a Sarah Palin and a Hillary Clinton, and people would say that there are many, is that when quizzed by the estimable journalist Katie Couric on things like what's going on in the world, Sarah Palin has a really hard time with that. A lot of Republicans and many, many Democrats we know don't love Hillary Clinton. But Hillary Clinton is not Sarah Palin.
I would say what they have in common is they both have a lot of people who really don't like them. They both have very high negatives, you know. And so, I mean, yeah, Hillary Clinton's a little more sophisticated than Sarah Palin. But they both have a lot of baggage and a lot of troubles. And I mean, there are a lot of people out there that just don't like Hillary Clinton and, you know.
I have to ask for some analysis on ask for some analysis on Hillary Clinton is a little more sophisticated than Sarah Palin.
Well, and to your point, the voters of Connecticut certainly agree. More than 60% of them decided that she is prepared to be president. She has the temperament to be president, whereas nearly 70% of them said Donald Trump lacks those qualities. Of course, despite that huge disparity, Mr. Trump only trails her in this state by 7 points, which, again, is just another one of those moments in this election year where we all kind of go, huh?
Yeah, so this is a Q poll that came out yesterday that Paz is referring to, the first of two Q polls. We have another one today about something else, which I assume we'll also talk about. But so what should looking at that Q poll, I think the number that probably should scare Clinton people a little bit is that she trails by 5% among unaffiliated voters. That's probably not a permanent problem. I think there's already a bigger bleed among Republicans away from Trump and towards Clinton than there is a comparable bleed among Democrats away from Clinton and towards Trump. So that almost corrects for her problem among unaffiliateds. And I'm assuming that, you know, after last night, and if Trump continues to dysfunction, all of these numbers will start to probably work a little bit more in her behalf. But as a snapshot, and that's all a poll ever is a snapshot of a moment. As a snapshot of that moment, the fact that she's actually behind among unaffiliated voters is just not a good thing.
Yeah, Suzanne?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it doesn't look good for her. And I think, was she properly vetted during this primary process? I know, you know, some people, it's been a bruising process, but maybe from the left, I don't know that she really has been vetted. All of the dirt and the baggage. I mean, think about the stuff that Trump is going to say about her. I mean, he is going to dig into every, you know, closet that she has. And we know that there are a lot of them. I think the Clinton Foundation stuff isn't going to go away. I just think this is going to get so negative and dirty.
But I think one of the problems, though, with Donald Trump candidacy, Paz, is that he will dig into all the closets. And he said last night he's going to give a speech probably Monday that will say everything that he knows about the Clintons. The only problem is that he also has this tendency to say things about closets that don't even exist and make up planets on which there are closets that haven't even been invented yet. And that's part of the problem as he tries to vet for the American public Hillary Clinton, is he's not necessarily the most consistent carrier of a message, let's just say.
Well, I noticed they did introduce Mr. Trump to a teleprompter yesterday.
Yes.
For his speech. And he
sounded weird, didn't it?
It did sound weird. And he, of course, that's something he took great delight in mocking Hillary Clinton for and mocking his opponents throughout the primary season. So on a serious note, the question is, has Donald Trump finally made a pivot of any kind towards delivering a disciplined, issue-oriented message, one in which he does more than pronounce, I will create jobs, I will improve security, without ever answering the question which Jake Tapper posed to him something like 46 times during that interview, how? How and how?
Yeah, well, Jake Tapper also posed some other questions to him, Colin. I mean, it's not often we get to say on the Wheelhouse, nice work out of Jake Tapper. But indeed, it seems as though he did press the candidate on a number of things, including his distasteful and Paul Ryan says racist comments about the judge who's hearing the case over Trump University.
Well, look, Donald Trump has had a horrible series of 3 or 4 days, which he's trying to turn around as of last night. That's the reason he had a speech that was in a teleprompter. He's in such a bad spiral right now. I almost said death spiral, but it's not quite that bad. But he's in such a bad spiral, he's got to turn things around. He's been denounced, as you said, by Paul Ryan as having made a textbook example of a racist remark. Mark Kirk in Illinois has de-endorsed Trump. And he was also denounced by Mitch McConnell and a bunch of other prominent Republicans. I mean, people whose support is basically pretty necessary for Trump, even given the kind of rogue candidacy that he's running, are not comfortable with him right now. That's really bad. And in a way, both parties have the same problem, which is they have to be able to get people to vote for their ticket without necessarily endorsing everything that's gone on. I mean, the Democrats have the same problem, right? They ultimately have to frame this, and probably convention narratives are going to be very important. So the Democrats have 46 days, I think, to set up a convention where they can send a message saying, look, you please vote for Hillary Clinton. Please believe in what we're doing as a party. You may not have liked everything. You might be a Bernie Sanders supporter who's still a little irritated, or you might be, and there's, I think, one of the undocumented groups of voters is people who are probably going to vote for Hillary Clinton because either they're Democrats or Democrat-leaning unaffiliated who just haven't been really comfortable at all with this, the way this process unfolded. The way in which, you know, there didn't seem to be much choice. In order to get a choice, they had to have a guy run who's essentially not even a member of the party. You know, all the actual members of the party had been cowed into submission, you know, and then there's like this debate schedule where it's all on Saturday nights and stuff. I mean, I think a lot of people, I'm one of them, you know, I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton, but I wouldn't want people to think that my vote for Hillary Clinton represented an endorsement of a process that struck me as having most of the oxygen squeezed out of it from the very beginning.
Well, and we just got a tweet from Russell who says, I'm trying to convince as many of my fellow Bernie supporters as possible that voting Trump just to vote against Clinton is a bad move. I think the bigger issue is going to be getting those Bernie supporters' paths to show up and vote for Hillary Clinton at all, as opposed to just sitting this one out. It's why I wanted to get back to this process. Colin just said one of the big arguments for many Sanders supporters has been the legitimacy of this process. The first time maybe we've looked under the hood of the way the Democrats choose a presidential candidate with all these superdelegates and these crazy debates on Saturday nights. It's felt for a long time to many supporters of Bernie Sanders that this wasn't a fair process. Monday night comes along, and as you said before, just before this last big push where Bernie Sanders has a chance to maybe do some damage in California and go into this convention with a slightly different narrative, the AP counts everything up and says, Hillary's clinched it. Now, as a member of the press, I'm the sort of person who likes to think, well, when we know stuff and we know it for sure, we say it because it's true. But there's a longstanding tradition of on an election day, you wait until the polls are closed until you say who won, even if you know who won, because you really can't influence the process. Does the AP clinching it for Hillary the night before of this primary sort of soil the whole thing?
It certainly deflated Clinton's moment. But it's a little different than reporting an exit poll while the polls are still open for a specific election, such as the California primary, which the AP did not do, CNN did not do. But yes, the optics are very similar. And it did feed into this suspicion that Bernie's people had that everybody's against us. The timing unquestionably was odd. But as the AP has said, and the New York Times did a fairly good story about this, saying, well, what are we going to do? Sit on it until after Tuesday night so Hillary Clinton can have a moment and Bernie Sanders doesn't feel slighted? That would have been weirder. So, look, you know, the news broke when the news broke. But as far as the questions about the process, you know, Hillary Clinton is going to be making the argument now saying, look, I won the popular vote. I have won the delegate count. The delegates that are apportioned as a result of primary results, even without the superdelegates, I am the presumptive Democratic nominee. But it's going to take some time for the Bernie people to get past that. Not all of them will. In Connecticut, I think they're in a little bit better shape. I was at the Democratic State Central Committee meeting last night where they selected the final batch of delegates. And it was done by consensus between the Clinton and Sanders campaigns. So at least on the ground in Connecticut, you have the practitioners looking at delegate selection with an eye towards, yes, you're a Bernie delegate, you go and you defend his interests at the convention. But keep in mind, you know, when the gavel comes down at the end, the goal of that party will be to defeat Donald Trump.
Yeah. And I think, though, the process kind of feeds into the narrative that Donald Trump is going to want to put forward, that Hillary's a top down elitist, you know, sort of part of the past, where Donald's coming out of the people, this populist, you know, kind of the new turn of politics today. So I spoke to someone yesterday who works for the Trump campaign, and they're thrilled that Hillary won. You know, they felt like she was the only candidate that they could really beat.
Well, and all the polls, the Quinnipiac poll most recently bears that out. I mean, Bernie Sanders still held a bigger lead over Donald Trump in a general election runoff than Hillary Clinton does.
That's right. And I think really, I think this baggage that she carries, partially because she is, you know, I mean, we had Clinton Bush, you know, I think the Clintons thought they were going to be running against Jeb Bush and it was going to be, well, two people from the past, so it's not such a big deal. But it didn't work out that way. There was this huge populist upsurge you know, among the people of America.
I like the idea that the American version of something new is picking a guy whose name is on every single thing in America. Colin?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a lot of different reactions to that. First of all, I think the Sanders numbers are very misleading. Sanders may have a glass jaw for all anybody knows. He hasn't really taken a punch so far. Clinton's strategy against him was to not dig him up too much for fear of alienating his base. So, I mean, she's taken every imaginable punch, and so has Trump. The guy who really hasn't ever been tested is Sanders. I would think his numbers are kind of inflated on that basis. So the other thing I would say about all of this other stuff, this superdelegate stuff is really fascinating to me. You know who's really interested in superdelegates right now? Republicans. I listened to a panel that had one of the leading Republican national political consultants on it over the weekend. You know, and his point was, wow, if we had superdelegates the way the Democrats did, we wouldn't have Harambe the gorilla running for president right now. We'd have somebody we actually wanted. You know?
Well, and so, I don't say what I say to defend Donald Trump. Yeah. I'm not trying to defend him and what he stands for and what he says. I'm just saying, you know, this is the narrative that's going to come out of that campaign, that Clinton is this elitist top-down candidate, and they're the candidate of the people in this populist upsurge, you know, that's happening right now.
But that wasn't the process. I mean, Clinton, to use that tired phrase, she sucked up all the air in the room. Nobody else other than Bernie, who got in really, let's be honest, as a protest candidate. When you try to talk to Bernie Sanders about his personal qualifications for president, he gets really prickly. He will not go there. He says, I'm here to talk about issues. Well, if you're a real candidate, you're also here to talk about qualifications. So yes, it was a very weird process where Clinton cleared the decks and then Bernie caught fire. You're right. The populist fire took off.
But before we get into the break, I just have to ask Suzanne one last thing, though. If part of the narrative is, where do Bernie supporters go? What do they do? Can Hillary count on them? Is there some sort of detente at the Democratic convention? So where do you and all the Republicans who are like, I can't believe that Donald Trump is my candidate, what do you do now?
I don't know. I mean, I was just listening to Colin's show on the way on the Libertarian ticket. I think there will be some movement over there. I think it depends where you live and it depends what your priorities are. You know, I mean, a lot of people are very concerned about the Supreme Court. That's going to be a huge issue. So, and again, if you really don't like Hillary Clinton, you really don't like Donald Trump, it's an awful year.
The two conventions may be very similar, and the overall messages of the campaigns may be very similar in the sense of please don't stay home and please don't go vote for some other party. And the Libertarians are interestingly poised this year. I mean, Gary Johnson and Bill Weld, these are not, you know, Lyndon LaRouche wackos. These are pretty recognizable politicians who've effectively governed states in the past. So, yeah, I mean, there might be maybe some bleed over in that direction.
And in that Quinnipiac poll we talked about earlier, with third-party candidates in the race, Hillary Clinton leads 41-36% with Gary Johnson and the Green Party candidate Jill Stein getting in the race. So that is something to watch. We're going to come back after our break and talk more about state policy and politics, a little bit about what didn't happen with the second chance legislation that we all thought was going to make a big splash at the state capitol this year. We're talking with Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show, Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, and Mark Pazniokas of the Connecticut Mirror. This is The Wheelhouse on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, and our own Colin McEnroe. Hey, Colin, what's on your show this afternoon at 1?
Every year we do a show that makes absolutely no one happy, often makes people very, very angry. We should
stop. Just the once a year, huh?
Yeah, well, there's that, too. But, yeah, we should definitely stop doing this show, but we refuse to do it. Every year we talk about what will be the song of the summer, and it's always a song. There can only be one song of the summer. It's a consensus choice. Every year you basically, by the end of the summer, know what it was. And so we attempt to predict it today, and it's never anything that anybody likes. I mean, you know, 2/3 of our audience thinks it should be something by the Love and Spoonful or something. So anyway, prepare to get annoyed.
It will not be Happy Days Are Here Again.
I was going to say, no, that is true. I never know what the song of the summer is until after I hear the show every year at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. Lawmakers met for special session last week, and they were expected to take up Governor Malloy's signature Second Chance Society legislation. We thought at least they'd take up one piece of it. Ultimately, though, it was not taken up.
I think we've started a substantial in-state dialogue and a substantial national dialogue on this issue. And I'm hopeful. In fact, I know that the United States is reexamining its positions on criminal justice and criminal justice reform.
Paz, last week we thought it was pretty certain that at least one piece of this, the bail reform piece of this, was going to be taken up. The other part had already been excised out, the part having to do with juvenile offenders. Were you surprised that this did not make it into the final action in the special session?
As it unfolded, no. I was, if you'd asked me a week earlier, if he had compromised in a way that he did and just focused on bail and then showed that he was open to limiting what misdemeanors would be covered by his reform, which very simply was he was going to eliminate bail for most, not all, but most misdemeanors. You know, there would be exceptions for violent crimes, and judges still would have discretion. But it became clear that there was no appetite, particularly in the House, to take this up in election year. People are very rattled. And if the poll that came out this morning had come out a week ago, they probably wouldn't have even shown up to have the discussion.
We'll talk more about the results of that poll in a moment. But speaking of the House, here's the House Minority Leader, Themis Claridis, talking about it.
I've heard some of the governor's spokespeople in the past few weeks mention, well, it would leave a $15 million hole if we don't pass this. Well, first of all, shame on you for building it in when you have no idea if this is going to pass. But more importantly, all of a sudden you've become fiscally responsible with public safety. That's where you decide you want to save money. When you're cutting social services, when you're cutting nonprofits, when you're cutting a disabled population money, and now you want to put people on the street that should be in jail?
So, Suzanne, this maybe is one of the issues with how this all got laid out. I mean, a lot of the argument for legislation like this around the country has been, and it saves money. It's good public policy. It's the right thing to do. And it's going to save us money long term. But when you build it into a budget in a contentious budget year, maybe that's not the right way to do it.
Well, and I think, too, it didn't really get off the ground right away because I think he wrapped it all in with this raise the age, which was, I think, a more contentious. There was less consensus around that issue than I think there was around bail reform. Senator Fasano actually had a bill in as well that would have canceled cash bail for nonviolent offenders, mostly drug offenders. And so I think there is some consensus around bail reform. We put out a paper earlier this year that suggested a holistic approach to bail reform, going to a completely non-cash bail system. What I'm hoping is that in the interim between now and next session, particularly after the election, you know, we can really talk about this in a holistic way. I think the governor was kind of trying to do it piecemeal and push something through. I think there are better reforms out there, and I think something good will come out of it.
The Yankee Institute is dead on the same page with the Pretrial Justice Institute, yes, which is a more left-leaning group. But the point was, perhaps this is something you can't do half measures. The director of the Pretrial Justice Institute disagreed with Molloy's approach to this piecemeal approach, that the idea of using charges as the basis as opposed to get rid of the cash bail and do what the Yankee Institute wants them to do, which is do a strict risk-based analysis. It doesn't matter if you charge with – now, remember, this is pretrial. These are people who have been are awaiting trial. They have not been convicted. There's a presumption of innocence. So the issue should be, are they a flight risk or are they a risk to the public safety? And there's a lot of data that says you can really cut down on the number of folks who are being held pretrial. It's better for them. It's better for society on a whole number of reasons. But the governor, I think, understandably tried to do a small piece to get people used to the idea. And in the end, it, you know, even that was attacked because the Republicans pointed out that even people arrested and are awaiting trial on misdemeanors, some of them have all these risk factors. And so carving out charges, they said, really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So it seems to be maybe you need to be in for the whole thing to make it work.
Yeah, I actually, Paz just said everything that I was going to say, but I just want to underscore, you know, The Yankee Policy Institute. Does everybody understand what the Yankee Policy Institute is? Their proposal was great. I mean, in fact, if it had just been incorporated as a bill, that would have been a much better bail reform bill than was actually drafted. But this is an issue now that slashes across party affiliations. And one of the understandings – I mean, conservatives like a few things about this. One of them is it's just a lot cheaper. You know, I mean, one of the numbers that gets kicked out is about $120 a day to keep somebody in jail awaiting trial – they can't make bail. You could do this sort of probation light, this way of kind of supervising them out there for $7, $10 a day. So it's just a heck of a lot cheaper to do it. But also, I think the other thing that conservatives like about this is that it allows you, if you're not spending a lot of time housing and dealing with people who aren't very scary, you can in fact devote more of your resources to dealing with the truly scary people and making sure they don't slip through the net. So I think that's one of the reasons that you know, you get a lot of consensus on this. And I guess it's maybe a measure of the dysfunction at the state capitol this year that something that really had bipartisan consensus nationally and ideologically couldn't achieve consensus or even get to the floor.
Well, and I just want to ask about that dysfunction a little bit. I mean, we've all given a lot of reasons why tactically maybe this wasn't the right thing to do and there's another way to approach this. I mean, Paz, I heard from some people in the state Senate who just said, you know, Democrats just didn't even like bring it up soon enough. I mean, there just wasn't the caucus discussion around this issue anywhere near soon enough to have it. Now, maybe that's because people are worried about it being election year. Maybe they don't want to deal with some of the things. But it's pretty important legislation that the governor, even as unpopular as he seems to be right now, did put forward and that has a lot of bipartisan support. You'd think you look at the proposal a little bit before it got time to vote.
They didn't engage, and I can't fully explain why. I mean, the governor floated the outline of the idea in November. He presented details then in February. And for whatever reason, it just – they did not get into a deep discussion of it. The Judiciary Committee did. The bail industry basically cut a deal. They cut a deal, say, don't do the holistic approach where it would wipe out our whole industry, but maybe focus on the misdemeanors. And so that piece actually was done in April as far as a deal. And you can't dismiss that. I mean, the bail bondsmen over the years have been surprisingly effective.
How lobbying. Big is the bail industry?
I know. It's not, but
they got Mrs. Dog the Bounty Hunter up there.
They're a very strong lobby.
Yeah, they are.
They really are. I mean, they spend a lot of money hiring lobbyists. I mean, look.
They're represented by the largest lobbying firm in the state,
Gaffney Bennett. And they're talking about something that's very personal and sensitive. It's
sure.
Public safety, right? At the end of the day, you have to convince people that we can do bail reform and still keep people safe. And I think you can, but I don't think the governor necessarily took that approach. And, you know, he gets a little combative. And instead of like working with
Stop.
People and trying to bring them all to the table, you know, even people like me, Colin, you know, I think he goes right to anger and he turns people off.
I mean, I think this is a big part of it. I would say I spent a good part of the weekend with a Superior Court judge. I was surprised. I mean, he hadn't really been briefed exactly.
But you did make bail eventually.
I did make bail. Yeah. He hadn't really been briefed that well on what was in the Malloy proposal. So, yeah, there's several problems, as has been suggested. Malloy doesn't have any chits he can call in. You know, as you get towards the end of the session, there are people who start saying, hey, I need this thing, right? And for you to prevail, people have to go, oh, you need it? Okay, we'll do it. But, I mean, Malloy just doesn't have that kind of traction at all with anybody in the General Assembly. Meanwhile, there were a lot of people going, I need not to have to cast a vote on this. I need this to not come to the floor because I don't want it to be an election issue. And those people's voices were heard because, in fact, they still had, you know, a handful of friends left in high places who would help them out.
Well, and that's why I think there's something more that can be done next year because it won't be an election year. And I really think we can take a more holistic, a better approach to this whole issue.
Well, so let's move on. You know, long link, obviously, between the Connecticut State Democratic Party and organized labor. Lori Pelletier, the president of AFL-CIO, organized a boycott and rally outside the Democratic fundraiser. She took a little hit for that. I know that you've been writing about this, Paz. This question about whether or not the relationship, the longstanding relationship between labor and the Democratic Party can actually be saved. I mean, are they in counseling right now?
Yeah, we had one of those hackneyed headlines, which I wrote, Can This Marriage Be Saved? And I was amazed at how people responded by saying, even some Democrats saying, God, I hope not. You know, like one guy, I mean, and this
you're
one,
better off.
And this wasn't a Democrat. This is a Republican who said, well, for the sake of the kids, I hope they get divorced.
Oh, your headlines are about to really start sizzling, by the way, but that's another story.
That's another story. It's labor's in a really bad place. They're angry. Look, there were layoffs. There's more layoffs coming. They could not get a serious hearing on the idea of raising taxes on the rich. And I think everybody at this table understands why that didn't occur. But where are they going to go? The Republicans are poised to do something they have not done since before Bill Clinton, which is to pick up seats in a presidential year. Normally, a great presidential year for the Republicans in the General Assembly is not to lose any seats. But, you know, they can taste it. They need 12 seats in the House. They need four seats in the Senate, depending on how you keep score by getting a tie and how things work. But anyway, they're in a position to really expand their influence. And labor's got to decide. We want to really slap at these Democrats who voted for a budget we don't like. But what's the end result? And there's a convention this week where they're going to do endorsements. So it'll be interesting to see who they endorse. But even above that will be the question of what force will the endorsements carry? How excited will people be to go out and do the hard work?
Yeah, I think a lot of this is going to have to do with framing. If labor would like to have to look for a – would like to look for a silver lining in today's Q poll people are asked how they feel about the 1,000 state layoffs. People overwhelmingly disapprove of that. They don't like it. Young people like it the least. 81% of them from ages 18 to 34 disapprove of it. Now, do they understand the issue? Do they understand the whole framework? Do they understand the competing interests? Because one of the problems right now is that labor in this state is effectively now put in a position where it has to compete against the delivery of services in certain instances. I mean, there's a very small pie that's being divided up in a very stingy way, and so the cutbacks of services, the other ways in which Connecticut residents perceive themselves as taking a budget hit, their aid to towns is going down, all this kind of stuff. I mean, there isn't really anything to give labor, and I think probably this issue is going to be framed in such a way as labor is going to be encouraged to give more ground themselves.
And I know as we have this conversation, Suzanne, something you've been writing about, thinking about an awful lot, it's not just this piece of the state budget, but the overall sustainability that we're talking about. This Q poll says most Connecticut residents, like 80% of them, think that we're in pretty bad economic shape. That's showing up in terms of how they feel about Governor Malloy, certainly. And as we look at this long term, it doesn't feel like there's an end in sight to this really bad economic condition that we're in.
No, I mean, we're not. There isn't. Things are not good. Last year. So the big story out of 2015 was the corporate tax increases, but they also increased taxes on personal income on the top. You know, if you want to top 1%, by 0.3%. So it was small tax increase, but it was a tax increase nonetheless. And yet they took in less revenue in terms of income tax. From one year to the next. So they're raising taxes and they're getting less money. That's not good. That shows, you know, that you're eroding your tax base. Now, that being said, the pie is not shrinking. The budget actually grew this year, just grew at a much slower rate than usual. They're still taking in more tax revenue than they've ever taken in before. The problem is things are growing so fast. The cost of some things are growing so fast. And most of those things have to do with labor. You know, and because those things are growing so fast, they're crowding out spending on everything else.
But not just labor, Paz, an enormous amount of debt. And I mean, just making debt service on what we owe, I mean, that could take up an even bigger chunk of the state budget than we have in the past.
And 22%,
something like that, going up to maybe like 30% if we actually want to pay it off, right?
So 35%. I think when Suzanne is mentioning labor, I think she's also talking about historic costs, legacy costs, pensions, healthcare benefits that the state owes, that the state is committed to. And yes, that is eating up more and more. So every year, the money that is – the spending that is truly discretionary – and I'm not talking about just what is legally discretionary, but what is practically discretionary – gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And that, in a nutshell, really is the fiscal crisis that Connecticut is facing now and will continue to face for the foreseeable future.
Every once in a while, we get these studies that come out that rank the states for various things. Colin, this week, or within the last week or so, George Mason University puts out one that says there's 54 states and plus Puerto Rico in terms of economic viability. Connecticut ranked 51st. But to be fair, we are ahead of Puerto Rico. I mean, yes, it seems bad now, and it seems bad potentially for many years to come.
Yeah, and I don't know. First of all, I feel as though these studies I don't know how much they actually help, because, in fact, really the way that business operates is much more complicated than that.
Sure, they don't really help at all.
Yeah, I think we all get the message, right? The message is that we can't continue as we have. I did think that Suzanne's piece this week about the fact that they raised taxes on the very wealthy and, in fact, the revenues didn't increase, they went down, that should be at least considered kind of a canary in the coal mine.
We're talking with Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. When we come back, the state's insurance commissioner is being asked by some to step away from a merger conversation. We're also going to talk a little bit more about baseball. You know, we can't get away from talking about the Yard Goats. Now it really seems like we're not going to have baseball in Hartford this year. Just a few of the things coming up this week on The Wheelhouse here on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow on Where We Live with Lucy Nalpathanchil. On this Saturday, you'll have no excuse to say there's nothing to do in our state. It's because it's the state's open house day for residents and visitors to explore the state from the smallest of historical sites to the largest of museums. We will preview just a sliver of all the good stuff that is out there. That's coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live. I hope you can join us. Today, we're in The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, talking with Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, and Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. As always, you can join us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. The state's insurance commissioner, Catherine Wade, is under renewed criticism for involvement in some insurance mergers. And one of these mergers involves Cigna, the company she previously lobbied for and her husband still works for. A Hartford Current editorial questions an increase in political contributions from these insurance companies. These two really big insurance mergers are something that are important to the state, Colin, for a couple of reasons. One has to do with a lot of the corporate jobs that are here, and it also has to do with the way in which we get healthcare insurance around the country. These are really important things. Should Catherine Wade be part of this conversation?
Well, I think absolutely not. I just want to backtrack for a second and say, yeah, apropos of Lucy's upcoming show, see these little museums now because of the cut to the humanities budget that was announced yesterday. Some of them might not be here in 6 months. So really use this open house day,
yes,
all right?
I know. The last open house day.
Go visit the most vulnerable museums because they may not be here.
The tour of Connecticut's vulnerable museums. That's a good idea.
So no, look, I mean, there were questions from the day that Catherine Wade was announced as a prospective nominee for this commissioner's job. There were questions about whether or not she would have conflicts of interest, whether she could function effectively in this job. It was brought up then. It's being brought up now. I think the difference is now it's a national story. Some of this is because of David Sirota, a guy who knows Connecticut politics very well, writing for the International Business Times, and then getting another group involved, Democracy in America, I think it's called. That's Howard Dean's brother, Jim Dean, I think, is the spokesperson for that. So suddenly there's a little bit of focus here on the state of Connecticut, where something that we've been a little uncomfortable about but maybe gotten a little numb to because it's been going on for months and months and months. The outside world is looking at this and going, what are you people doing? You've got a person who was formerly employed by Cigna, whose husband is currently employed by Cigna, which also means that some of their future assets are kind of tied up in Cigna's retirement program. Not hers so much. I think she divested or put stuff in a blind trust, but still his. You know, I mean, she just obviously has what most people would identify as a conflict of interest. But in fact, here we go.
It's one of the problems with the Connecticut Ethics Code. What Commissioner Wade is doing under our ethics rules appears to be legal. Can it pass the cocktail party test? I would say no. So there's that question. Look, this is an important issue. It's a time of consolidation in the health insurance industry. Cigna, Anthem, two big players. David's piece, you know, I think really well explored some of the trends and the big issues. I think it was a little overwrought of drawing the connection to—
As David can be.
As David can be. I met David when he was working for Ned Lamont
in 2006.
So David's one of these people who sort of straddled the line. I mean, he tends to be more of the crusader. You know, his opinions are out on his sleeve. But I do closely follow contributions to the Democratic Governors Association and certainly the Democratic Party. And Cigna really has not amped up their giving. Anthem did give a big check to the Democratic Governors Association, $475,000. No question. That was out of the, you know, broke the pattern. Cigna, no. So I'm not quite sure if that's really the issue here, that this is all about money and politics. It seems to be more a legitimate question about, will the public have confidence that the right decision is being made on approving a merger? And we should also add that the grounds upon which the Department of Insurance, the Commissioner of Insurance in Connecticut, will make that decision, it's very technical. It really isn't the purely antitrust. They look at a whole bunch of factors, many of which I am not qualified to explain. I will stipulate that for the record. But again, I think the larger question is, will the public have confidence the right thing is being done for the right reasons?
And just to read from that Hartford Current editorial about the money piece of it, they write there are also concerns about stepped up political contributions from Cigna and Anthem to the Democratic Governors Association, which Connecticut Governor Daniel P. Malloy now heads. The donations, they write, nearly quintupled in 2013 to 14 to $825,000, according to the International Business Times. What do they want for their money? Question mark, close quote. Anyway, Suzanne?
Yeah, she should be recusing herself from the Cigna decision. I mean, this, and it does definitely shine a light on our ethics code here in the state. It's not strong. It should be stronger. But it also, I mean, it's a tricky issue because in order to, you know, regulate a lot of these very complicated bodies, you need to have someone with expertise. And so she is someone with expertise, and that's why they brought her in. So it's a tricky issue. And what I really wish we had was more transparency about the process, about how they make the decision. That is not transparent.
No, and that's today's story, in fact, that lawyers or the administration has rebuffed an FOI request for more information about the process. And
there was a deputy – I believe she was a career person. There was a deputy commissioner who was very well regarded when Tom Leonardi left as commissioner. And
Lisa Dowling.
Yes. And yeah. Malloy passed her over for Katie Waite. So, yes, you're right.
Her history was at MassMutual, too. So it's not, I mean, people come out of the private sector. But I think what's disturbing here with Waite is she wants to do this, right? I mean, one possibility for her would have been to say, you know, I could probably pass the fine print test on this, but I know what the optics are, and I'm going to step aside so that nobody questions this decision and I've got other trained personnel within my office who can handle this. She wants to do this, and she's so insistent on doing this that that's one of the things that's ratcheting up suspicion.
An elected official would be more sensitive. You see that in the legislature all the time. Even though they can vote on things that, believe it or not, affect their employers, many of them don't just because, it doesn't look right. And in the case of the Attorney General George Jepson, when his wife is no longer at Cigna, but when she was, he stepped back because, again, he is an elected official. You know, he has a finer antenna about how these things look.
Speaking of things that just don't look right, thank you for the transition. Last week, we spoke about the city of Hartford declaring the developer of the minor league baseball stadium that's being built in downtown in default of its contract. This week, Mayor Luke Bronin removed the developer from the baseball stadium for the Hartford Yard Goats.
If they remain on the job, there's no question there's no baseball. I don't know whether there will be baseball played, but I can tell you that the only slim chance that there's going to be baseball played is by making a change.
Was this the next natural thing that was going to happen here, Colin?
I resent the way that question is phrased. To me, for my purposes anyway, the Yard Goats and this stadium has now become my kind of default setting for the word disaster. Like in the future, I'll say, well, that's a disaster, but not like the Yard Goat Stadium. You know, I mean, this is really horrible. The notion. Obviously, to anybody eyeballing this from the very beginning, it seemed unlikely that they'd be ready by April 7th. But the notion that you know, the people of Hartford will have bonded for $54 or $63 million, depending on which number you're counting, and not get a game played here in Hartford this year is really, really appalling. And, yeah, I mean, sure, the natural next step, yeah, you can watch these dominoes fall. We've been watching them happen. And yeah, in that sense, I guess it is the next natural step. This is another story that has moved outside our market. Other people are starting to look at it. My favorite thing is I think it was a commenter on Deadspin who said, looking at the – reading the name of the contractor a little bit differently, he said, shouldn't the name Do Know Hartford have been kind of a clue that, you know, maybe they wouldn't get this
it's
done?
It's pronounced Dono. Dono. Doesn't anybody see that pass?
Yeah, or it's going to be the Simpsons. Duh. Will this be the rare instance where litigation actually speeds something up?
Could be.
And, you know, it's going to be up to the surety company to come in and decide that it's in their interest to mitigate and limit their damages. So the question, I guess they do have a strong incentive to get this thing done as quickly as possible. But boy, every time, you know, anytime you see a contractor thrown off a site, it usually leads to more delay, not less. And in fact, I think that's why Bronin was reluctant to pull the trigger, as early as he could have, because it does shut it down for at least for a time.
And this is the sort of thing, Suzanne, you spend a lot of your time sort of looking at and trying to suss out instances of bad public policy and figuring out ways that we might do something different in the future. And if you look at this, Colin's calling it one of the biggest disasters he's ever seen. I mean, how big is the disaster around the Hartford baseball stadium right now?
It's huge. And I think, you know, when you get back to the taxpayers of Hartford, who must just be so frustrated that their money was spent in this way in the first place, and then this is what they end up with.
And they can't collect rent.
Right. I mean, there's, you know, so it and it just looks bad. I mean, Hartford's in such bad shape. When you peel back the layers of the books in Hartford, I mean, their finances are in such bad shape. Talk about debt. They carry a huge amount of debt. The stadium added to that debt. I mean, there's talk about them potentially entering bankruptcy in the next few years because things are so bad there. And yet, the stadium, you can't even play in it. I mean, it really, it kind of just, it's like, it just feels like it's piling on. I mean, I even feel bad for them. I mean, it's just.
Even you.
I've said this before, I think, on this show. Pedro Segarra is lucky. He lost the primary for mayor of Hartford because this was his deal. And at least Bronin can come in with clean hands on this and say, look, this was not my idea, but we're committed. This thing is going to be paid off by revenue bonds. So, folks, we need revenue to pay off the bonds. That means making this work. That means finishing it and keeping that team here because there's no other way around this.
We're going to finish off our wheelhouse this week with a look around some of the stories that we've been paying attention to that maybe haven't made quite as much news and we wouldn't normally talk about on the wheelhouse. What did you bring us, Colin?
I'll do two things really quickly. One of them is just this is very fast, but for, you know, we're talking about polls. We talk about polls every day. One thing that's really fun to look at, 538 does a rating of all the pollsters. I mean, like 100, 150 pollsters. It's fun to look at. So if you just go on 538.com and look for pollster ratings. By the way, Quinnipiac and UConn both do very well. They get very good grades. On a lighter note, well, actually, here's a little bit of audio that'll kind of set this up.
Hey, I'm Paul, and I used to ask if you could hear me now with Verizon. Not anymore. I'm with Sprint now.
That's Paul Marcarelli. He's from North Haven, or I think originally. Still keeps a home in Guilford, Connecticut. He was the Verizon guy. He made big news by switching to Sprint this week. I'm not sure where he pays his taxes, whether he's a Connecticut taxpayer or in New York or someplace else. But he does have a home in Guilford, and hopefully all the money he's going to get from Sprint, some of it will go into our state coffers.
We'll stay right here. Paz, I want to turn to you on a story that I know Colin talked about earlier this week on his show. Here's a little bit from Colin's program. This is Arnold Chase speaking on Monday about his late father, David Chase.
He, by deeds and by words, you know, he made us realize that none of us know, you know, when our last day will be.
Paz, you have about a minute here, but tell us, for those of you who don't know, who is David Chase?
David Chase, very simply, was a Holocaust survivor who came to this country at the age of 16 without a penny to his name. He was a charity case for United Jewish Appeal, and he became a tycoon. He became a real estate developer. He went into banking, insurance, broadcasting. And I did not meet anybody like him in my lifetime. Every reporter has a story that he regrets, and mine is a long Northeast Magazine profile of David Chase that never got published because Larry Bloom, the editor, insisted I go to Poland with David, and it never happened. But David had this incredible ability to be in the past and in the present at the same time. And I had a conversation with him about the Holocaust, about his survival, when he was taking phone calls in the course of the conversation about his far-flung business enterprises. Mm-hmm. And he could toggle back and forth to 1944 to the present day. And it was amazing, but also chilling at the same time.
Colin, just a few seconds.
I worked for Chase Enterprises because, in fact, they owned WTIC when I first went to work there. One of the last instances of local ownership of a major for-profit media outlet. So, what I said on Monday was, you know, we see a lot of rich people these days saying, what can Connecticut do for me? What can my home state do for me? David Chase usually said, what can I do for Hartford?
I just like to end with something that's not fun, but this week's news has not put me in a good mood. I was shaken by the news over the weekend that two NPR journalists, including photographer David Gilkey, was killed in Afghanistan. I just want to say that during a year when the presumed candidate of the Republican Party has called journalists dishonest and some of the worst people, this was a good guy who did great work. I had a lot of friends, have a lot of friends who were great friends of his. And I just want to say thank you, David Gilkey, and his colleague, Zabihullah Tamana, for your service to America. This is The Wheelhouse.